Good afternoon. We have a little different setup today, and so bear with me if I do this in a sort of clunky fashion, but we'll get through it. We have one case today before us, and that's 17-5023, Perry versus Duvero. Would counsel make your appearance?
Amber Gooch for the defendant, Sheriff Terry Duvero.
Please proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. We are here today on a qualified interlocutory appeal. The facts underlying this appeal are that the plaintiff alleges that she was sexually assaulted by a jailer in the Ottawa County Jail on February 25, 2013. At the summary judgment stage, I briefed qualified immunity, and the district court, the Northern District of Oklahoma, found that a reasonable jury could find that Sheriff Terry Duvero was deliberately indifferent based on three things. Those three things were: one, the policy of hiring only male jailers; two, the policy of allowing female staff to enter the pods of the female inmates only in an emergency; and three, the practice of male jailers freely entering the female pods. I can respectfully disagree with the Northern District's ruling in this respect and contend that there, as of February 25, 2013, there was no existing precedent that should have put or should have that should have reasonably put Sheriff Terry Duvero on notice that those three things that I just identified were unconstitutional, and that's what the plaintiff must show in this case.
Those are qualified immunity arguments, clearly established law arguments.
Yes.
I did not discern any arguments on the first prong of the qualified immunity standard in your brief. Is that right?
That is essentially correct. The point of the qualified immunity appeal here is on the clearly established prong portion of the qualified immunity analysis.
So essentially your case stands or falls on that?
Yes.
Okay. If I could, let me focus for a moment on the jurisdictional argument, and specifically the case that gives me some pause is Henderson versus Glantz. And this is how I read that case. It took the position, as I understand it, that when the district court makes a finding, and in that case it was risk awareness, whether the defendant was aware of the risk, if the defendant on appeal challenges certain subsidiary findings that essentially would call into question that overarching finding, risk awareness, then the defendant actually has challenged the facts that would allow for us to have jurisdiction. In other words, the defendant would have actually been contesting the facts, and therefore we would not have interlocutory jurisdiction. That's how I read Henderson. Reading Henderson that way, what troubles me about your case, and I'd like for you to help me with this, is that the court here said that there made a finding that there was a substantial, I think the word it used is substantial risk of increased risk of sexual assault. In other words, there was a finding of an increased risk of sexual assault. That finding was predicated on knowledge existing as it relates to men freely and coming and going in the women's pod, and I think there was also, it was reasonable to assume that male detention officers would enter the female pod, and then there was also a tribal issue as to them freely entering the female pod. My question is this: throughout your brief, I discerned you arguing, contesting that the defendant knew about men entering the female pod. Is that right?
I do assert that in the brief, yes, Your Honor.
Well,
but I contend for purposes of this appeal that, let's take that off the table.
Well, that's not what you've done in the brief, though. I mean, constantly in the brief, there's a reference to the fact that the defendant did not know that the men were entering the female pod. Now, are you saying that right now you're willing to strip that out of what you've said previously?
For purposes of the qualified immunity interlocutory appeal, I will concede that, well, I'm not making the argument, let me put it the way. I'm not trying to argue that he, what knowledge the sheriff did or didn't have at that time.
Well, it would seem to me you would have to concede that he did know for purposes of
this argument and this appeal. Yes, I will concede that.
Okay.
Well, and counsel, Judge Morris here, wouldn't you have to concede that, even if you, I mean, you have to concede it for jurisdictional purposes, but you've also conceded the first prong, the constitutional violation, at least for purposes of this appeal, and within that decision that the district court made on that first prong is a finding of that knowledge. So haven't you conceded all of the facts necessary for that constitutional violation? Does that make sense?
I think I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. And I recognize the jurisdictional issue here in this interlocutory appeal. And what I'm trying to express and convey is, for purposes of this appeal, I will concede the facts as found by the court or as alleged by the plaintiff up to this point, and for purposes of this argument only. And from there, my argument is that the law was not clearly established on February 25th, 2013. That
counsel. This is Judge Matheson. I just need to take the last two questions one step further. If you're not contesting prong one of qualified immunity and you're conceding the facts underlying a constitutional violation, does it also follow that you're conceding that your client was deliberately indifferent to the risk in this matter?
No, Your Honor, I cannot concede that.
Isn't that an element of the violation?
For purposes of qualified immunity, the plaintiff has to show that her constitutional or her clearly established constitutional rights were violated, and clearly established. My focus here, for purposes of this appeal, is on the clearly established. When taken in context with the specific facts of the case that we have, which I concede for purposes of this argument, were found by the district court or as alleged by the plaintiff.
With that,
but counsel, sorry.
Please go ahead, Judge Morris.
Sorry.
Go ahead, please.
Counsel, the problem we have is, in order to reach that constitutional violation and make that finding, the district court specifically had to find that there was an inference that could be drawn, that a substantial risk of serious harm existed based on the facts that had been found, and that the defendant actually drew that inference. So regardless of what you now think, whether the facts supported that or not, you've waived that argument. So we have to assume that there were facts found from which an inference could be drawn that a substantial risk of serious harm existed, and that inference was made. How is it that the law was not clearly established that with those inferences, does this make sense to you? I feel like you've given up the argument you're trying to make on the clearly established prong, is what I'm trying to say, I guess.
Well, I respectfully don't feel that I have. The dispositive inquiry on the issue of qualified immunity, and this is what the court in the Mullinex v. Luna case cited and was re-urged by the White v. Pauley court, the dispositive question is whether the violative nature of the particular conduct is clearly established, and this inquiry must be undertaken in light of the specific context of the case and not as a broad general proposition.
Okay. No, please go ahead.
And my argument is, as to those specific, those three specific things that I referenced earlier in my argument that the court found was sufficient for to go to a jury, essentially, there is no case on point. The district court did not cite a case on point with facts same or similar to those here. Plaintiff has not presented a case on point with facts that are same or similar to what we have here. And that's all particularly telling in light of the district court's finding that there had been no prior sexual assault or a history of sexual assaults in the jail, coupled with the district court's finding, and as uncontested by plaintiffs, that there was training provided to jailers about sexual conduct that was considered obviously inappropriate with inmates.
So even if we're accepting all of the facts of your client being deliberately indifferent, now let's be clear here. Even if we accept that, the point then is, whether there was clearly established law under as deliberate indifference manifested itself here, whether there was clearly established law that would have declared that to be a constitutional violation, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And on that, the case that gives me a little bit of pause is Tafoya, and the reason it does that is that one of the prongs of the district court this question of blind spots and the existence of blind spots. There were blind spots in the shower, blind spots in the rooms, and there was some reference to a blind spot in a mechanical room. Now, Tafoya viewed that as significant in his determination of deliberate indifference, that there in fact had been blind spots there, and that when the sheriff increased surveillance, he did not fully address the blind spots. So what do you say about that in terms of whether Tafoya would therefore map onto this case?
Tafoya, in my opinion, Your Honor, is distinguishable from this case for a couple of reasons. The blind spots that you referenced that we have in this case, there were essentially two blind spots. One, a blind spot in the shower area of the female jail, the female cells. The shower area included the shower and the toilet. And then two, the mechanical room that you did reference.
There's also the rooms, right? I mean, there were three. I mean, I saw in the brief, there's the rooms of the inmates themselves.
Oh, that's right. You're right. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, the actual rooms themselves.
Okay.
But in Tafoya, there were numerous other problems in the facts of the case. There, the sheriff was aware of previous assault, sexual assault. In Tafoya, the sheriff was on notice of dangerous conditions in the jail and aware that of the conditions and problem actions that had gone on in the jail in the Tafoya case to contribute to those. He was aware of the cameras in the jail. He also didn't have a proper training protocol. There were a multitude of facts that were present in the Tafoya case that when you consider them all together allowed the court to find the way it found in Tafoya. We don't have those facts here. I recognize we have the issue of the blind spot, but we don't have an issue of prior assaults in the jail. We do not have an issue of lack of training, improper training in the jail. We don't, in our case, in this case, we also do not have any other problems that have been in evidence or presented by the plaintiff going on in the jail that should have put Terry Durbro on notice that this is an issue.
What about
the counsel?
Yes.
But don't we have the problem in this case that the policies that were in place to protect these inmates were not being followed? In other words, you had the policy of two guards needing to go into a cell in the female pod. You needed to have a female guard go in with the male guard. And those policies weren't being followed.
I'm approaching the end of my time. I was hoping to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Should I continue, or do I need to?
Well, I think I'd be interested in a response to the question.
Okay. Whether individuals in the jail were or were not following policy is not an issue in this case for purposes of Terry Durbro's qualified immunity. The three factors that the court relied upon in finding that a reasonable jury could find or allow this case to go to a jury did not involve what you just referenced, Your Honor, of jailers not following policy. And because the sheriff in this case is sued individually, the qualified immunity analysis on the clearly established portion of it has to focus on what law was clearly established that could have reasonably put him on notice that those three things that the court and the plaintiffs have taken issue with would have been unconstitutional.
We started, and if we need to allow a couple more minutes, we'll do that. Let's just get at the bottom of this. When we started, you said you were willing to accept the knowledge finding, and that knowledge finding was based upon the fact that there were guards going in and out freely into those pods. That was a violation of policy. And so, in fact, that policy violation is part of your case. I mean, there was a policy of the jail that shouldn't happen, and according to the court, the risk of sexual assault, there was a substantial risk of sexual assault that your client would have been deliberately indifferent in not acknowledging, and that substantial risk was based upon the coming and going, which was a violation of policy, right?
But none of that could have given, when you consider the totality of the circumstances, none of that, the violations that you're referencing of going in and out of the pods or the cells, could have given a reasonable official in the position of the sheriff pause to think there might be a sexual assault ongoing. When you have, consider in light of the fact of the training that was provided, there is no failure to train claim here. It's undisputed the extensive amount that was provided. And when you take into account there is not a history of any prior sexual assaults before this. I'm sorry?
What was the purpose, counsel, of that policy of not allowing the male guards to go in absent an emergency? What was the purpose of that policy? And if you know that that policy is being violated regularly, which is a finding we have here, why can't you make that next inference, which is that he also knew that the very purpose of the policy, which was to prevent this kind of sexual assault, was implicated?
That's a tough question, Your Honor. I'm just going to fall back on what I've tried to consistently say here, that which is that for purposes of this qualified immunity appeal and the clearly established prong, there was no case sufficient to put him on notice that the things that we're all talking about here, the policy violations or the hiring only men to work in the jails or allowing females to enter the pods only in a case of an emergency, there's no case on point, nor has the plaintiff cited one, nor did the district court cite one, that should have put him on notice that this is unconstitutional. When you consider that there was training to prevent it, the jailer at issue in this case had that training, and there had never been a problem of this like this at all prior to this.
If I understand, and I think Ardell is here somewhere, if I understand this timing correctly, we're now a minute 20 over.
Yes, we are.
Why don't we see how things go with the other side, and then we'll work on rebuttal accordingly, okay?
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Bob Blakemore from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I represent the plaintiff appellee in this case. And after listening to Ms. Gooch's argument, I'm trying to kind of drill down now into where we are as far as what the issue is.
Where we are is where is the case that is clearly established law for this circumstance.
Right.
And so why don't you give us one? What's your best case?
My best case is the Tafoya case, sir. And part of what was just being discussed with Ms. Duke is the policy violations. One of the policy violations that we just discussed is the fact that there was this pervasive practice of male detention officers entering the female pod alone for extended periods of time. In addition to that, there was also a policy that as a matter of their practice at the Ottawa County Jail, they would not hire female detention officers at all, which in essence nearly made it impossible to comply with that policy.
Well, what do you do with our Hoverter case, which said that it's not an Eighth Amendment violation to have same gender people in a jail? I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with that.
Right.
Different gendered, I'm sorry.
Well, what I would say with respect to the Hoverter case, there's another similar case, and that is the Pulsifer case. And in Hoverter, the plaintiff's claim was based on nothing more than the fact that she was a female inmate, and that's a quote from Barney.
Well, my point is then you were trying to lay significance on the fact that they had they only hired men.
Right.
Well, Hoverter seems to me to undercut for Eighth Amendment purposes the significance of that, unless you got more.
Well, there is more. I mean, as far as the notice that Mr. Durbrow had, there is evidence that not only that there was a history of problems at the jail with respect to the violence against women.
What history are you talking about? There was only the 2008 incident that turned out to be nothing. What other history
and
are you...
In 2012.
Which he did not even know about.
Well, I think that's a contest.
How can it
that.
Be contested when you've got a sworn statement from him and there's nothing in the record to the contrary, is there?
I think circumstantially the fact that it was his jail, it was his investigation that he asked for from the OSBI.
It was his jail. They produced a report. He doesn't have the report. Why circumstantially does that mean he knows what happened?
Your Honor, they produced that report to us through discovery. He obviously had it.
Well, he got it for litigation purposes. That doesn't mean he had it at the time, does it?
Well, I think there's an issue of fact as to whether or not the fact that it's in their possession, they asked for this investigation to be done. I think there's an issue of fact as to whether he knew. And beyond that...
Well, counsel, I'm sorry, finish, and then I have a question. I apologize.
Well, and beyond that, the other one I was going to raise, and it's not specifically that I recall addressed by the district court, is that there was evidence that one of the inmates, a Natalie Buzzard, actually submitted a written request to staff to Sheriff Durbrow.
Well, let's talk about that. Okay. That seems to me pretty weak. It wasn't testimony from Ms. Buzzard, was it? It was testimony from somebody else saying what Ms. Buzzard did.
Right.
Do we have a time on when that took place?
No, we don't have.
Okay. We have no evidence at all in the record that Durbrow ever saw that, do we?
Well, we don't know.
Well, we don't know. Well, we don't know is a question mark.
It was addressed to him.
Okay. Well, that doesn't do much for us, does it, if it's a question mark?
Well, in the context of a summary judgment.
In a context of a summary judgment, you need facts. And the fact that there is something submitted and you have nothing that indicates that he received it, what does that do for you? That leaves an open question.
Right.
Period.
Well, she submitted there's evidence that she submitted the that request to staff to the sheriff.
Not through her testimony.
Right.
Mr. Blakemore, could I ask you to go back? You were talking about Tafoya, and then you sort of seem to be alluding to the various facts that you think would cause this case to be similar to that. I guess I would like to know where, if there's something in this report that you seem to want to rely on that the sheriff says he never saw, even assuming he saw it, if there's something in that report that would equate to the kind of facts that were significant in Tafoya, which, as I recall, was there'd actually been, under the same sheriff just 3 years earlier, there'd been some sexual assaults by guards. Those guards ended up convicted. They actually had prison time for those assaults under this same sheriff. Is there anything like that would liken this case to Tafoya?
With respect, no, there were no convictions. It was a credible report and complaint from a female inmate that she was beaten by his jail administrator, Randall Lloyd, is what it was in 2012. But comparing it to Tafoya, where I was beginning to go with this, is that one of the findings that was made by the Tafoya court is that failing to enforce a no contact policy because there was, and this is a quote, no contact policy because there was not always a female detention officer on duty was one of the factors that Tafoya looked at in determining that there was a genuine issue of fact for trial as to whether or not there was a constitutional violation. And we have that, I think, in spades in this case, as far as the pervasiveness of this. And part of going back to knowledge and how we could make the case that Sheriff Durbrow had knowledge, this is not a case that just involves the single incident involving our client. This is a case of widespread abuse by this supervisor at the jail involving multiple female inmates.
So much counsel of the about this particular individual, so much of it came up after the fact, after this alleged rape. reports of other, through some pretty, yes, significant reports, but this was all after the fact. And you can't rely on that.
Well, what I was about to say is that the pervasiveness of this and the fact that it went on for so long, you can prove notice, you can prove the state of mind through circumstantial evidence, and the fact that this was as blatant and pervasive as it was in the Ottawa County Jail, and this is not, we're not talking about a large facility here. I think that you could infer from the pervasiveness of the violations involving multiple women over an extended period of time that that Mr. Durbaro had notice of the violations.
Is it a trial court? Go ahead, Judge. I'm sorry.
Counsel, I have a slightly different question about Tafoya. Tafoya was decided before the Supreme Court decided the Iqbal case and before this court decided Dodds. And my question is whether Iqbal and Dodds unsettled the law of supervisory liability to the extent that we really shouldn't be relying on a pre-Iqbal case like Tafoya for clearly established law. Could you comment on that?
Yes, sir. I believe that Tafoya fits within the construct of Dodds, that essentially that you can establish supervisory liability through evidence that there was a policy or custom for which the, in this case, the sheriff or the official had responsibility for that, that was a moving force behind the violation. And I think when you look at Tafoya, it's pretty clear that what they're talking about are multiple policies and customs, policy violations, the blind spot issue. That Judge Holmes noted, that's specifically addressed in Tafoya and by the district court, and so I think that Tafoya fits still and is still good authority for the purposes of establishing whether or not there's supervisory liability.
Did you argue Tafoya in the district court?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do you have anything else besides that case for clearly established law?
There's one other one that I think I would call the court's attention to, and that's and again I'm not going to go with the as the Supreme Court has said a highly generalized analysis, but this case I think is sufficiently specific that it would put the sheriff on notice that the conduct was unconstitutional, and that's the Keith versus Corner case. And in this instance, I'm talking about the first Keith case, which was actually on the motion to dismiss that case, and it was. I honestly don't think I realized this at the time that I was doing my brief, but it was issued on February 12, 2013, which was about 7 days before the rape of Mrs. Perry in this case.
Was it published? Was that a published case?
Yes, and the site is...
The first one?
Yes, it's 707 F3rd 1185.
Well, doesn't the second Keith case have within it, even though it came out after the events here, doesn't it say that as of 2007 there was the law was clearly established as it relates to the obligation to protect inmates from sexual assault in a penal context? Didn't it say that?
Oh yes, with that general principle of law has definitely been clearly established as far as the duty of law enforcement and in this case the sheriff to protect.
But more particularized would be the first decision.
Well, I think that both of them, I would concede that when you're looking at the particulars of the second Keith decision, since it came out in 2016, that we can't really rely on that.
Okay.
Other than to the extent that it cites earlier precedent. But the first Keith, the part of the first Keith case is that I would point the court to is that there was a finding that structural policy problems in their vocational training program and insufficient use of cameras to monitor inmates and staff suggested that the warden disregarded a substantial risk of abuse despite being aware of the problem.
Did you rely on the first Keith case before the district court?
I did not cite it. And then looking just at the issue on a more general view, it is, and I believe this is the quote that you just read, Judge Holmes, that, this is from Keith 1. It is clearly established that a prison official's deliberate indifference to sexual abuse by prison employees violates the Eighth Amendment.
You don't rely on Keith 1 in your appellate brief, do you?
No, sir, but it is a Tenth Circuit case.
It is a 2013 case, but you don't make an argument based upon it in your appellate brief.
That's correct, sir.
Okay.
Are there any other? I guess my time is up. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Gooch, 20 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to reiterate that for purposes of my argument here today on the qualified immunity argument, the clearly established prong that as of February 25th, 2013, there was no case on point with same or similar facts that would have put Sheriff Durbro on notice that hiring male detention officers, allowing female detention officers to enter the pod only in an emergency, and having an awareness that male officers freely enter the pod. Those three things, coupled with no prior history of any kind of sexual assault, and coupled with the training that's undisputed that was provided to this jailer and all jailers on the issue of sexual contact with inmates. All of that big ball of wax, to me, warrants a finding of reversing the district court on the issue of qualified immunity because it was not clearly established that these acts were unconstitutional at the time and thus caused the plaintiff or Ms. Perry's constitutional right to be violated.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. We understand your argument. Thank you for your arguments, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
With court, we'll stand at recess until further call.
Thank you.